Good morning. First argument this morning would be TGI Insurance versus Giffen Winning. Mr. Balsam.
Excuse me. May it please the court, counsel. In this suit, my client, TIG Insurance Company, seeks damages for attorney's fees it had to spend defending a motion for sanctions brought in some part, at least, due to the defendant law firm's failure to produce certain gender equity studies in the underlying employment suit. It is undisputed that the defendant failed to produce these studies that were in their possession, that the plaintiffs in the underlying case brought a motion for sanctions alleging the failure to produce these studies as a basis for entering a default judgment, that Latham & Watkins, the attorneys hired to defend the sanctions motion, charged a considerable sum to do so, that Giffen Winning certified Latham's bill as reasonable and TIG paid it, and that at least some of the conduct that Latham had to defend was Giffen & Winning's failure to produce the studies. So for this reason, for the district judge in these circumstances to say as a matter of law that TIG could not establish causation or any damages, we submit was error. Now, Giffen Winning has effectively conceded error in the district judge's barring our expert on the standard of care and its breach. So this morning I will primarily address causation and damages and, time permitting, the collateral source rule. For the rest of the issues, I'll stand on my brief unless the court has any questions. First, the issue of causation, specifically cause in fact. Under Illinois law, causation is established if the harm resulted in whole or in part from the negligent act. Here, a jury could easily find that some or all of the money spent defending against the sanctions motion was attributable to the failure to produce these gender equity studies. Now, Giffen Winning has said that for all we know, Bellows, who is the plaintiff's attorney in the underlying suit, might have filed the sanctions motion even if Giffen Winning had produced the studies. Well, that's not the relevant issue on causation. The question on but-for causation is, would the same result have happened even if Giffen Winning had produced the gender equity studies? And the answer to that is no, because there's plenty of evidence from which a jury could find that it would have been a far different sanctions motion with a far different response on Latham's part. The only conduct alleged, had the studies been produced, would be ISU's failure to produce a database that was ultimately found not to exist. It just would have been a much less serious issue. Mark Mester, the lead counsel for Latham, testified at his deposition that he would not have been as concerned about the failure to produce a non-existent database as he was concerned about the failure to produce gender equity studies in a case involving gender disparity in pay.
What did Bellows put in his affidavit?
Well, that's a good question, because in the affidavit, he concentrated on both the failure to produce the gender equity studies and the failure to produce this database that ultimately was turned out not to exist. So our position is that the documentary evidence alone, a jury could look at that and determine at least that some of the time spent on the sanctions motion was attributable to the failure to produce the gender equity studies, because this was one of the main themes running through his affidavit and through the sanctions motion.
Now, he did this after, what's his name, Gorell, his other client, came up with these documents. Is that when this?
Right.
When he discovered them?
That's correct, Judge Mann.
And were these documents the smoking gun that everybody's looking for? Were they so overwhelming that suddenly they realized that these 200 and some boxes they went through, it was all capsulized right there?
Well, they were the smoking gun to the extent that a jury could look at. I mean, we're here trying to recover for the defense against a sanctions motion, and they were certainly a smoking gun in Bellows filing the sanctions motion. That was the one thing he could point to that wasn't produced. The database, he didn't know whether it existed or not, and it was ultimately turned out that it didn't exist. So Mester viewed it as the smoking gun. he was the one that was spending, he was the Latham attorney that was defending against the sanctions motion, and in his mind, that was the thing he was the most scared about. He devoted so much time to defending that sanctions motion because he was scared that Judge Mim would enter a default judgment based on the non-production of these documents. So to that extent, they were a smoking gun. That was his opinion, and a jury could certainly find that they were an integral part.
Well, with Metzger, the judge seemed to dismiss his testimony because he didn't allege any, or didn't allege any damages, or didn't know enough about to allege damages.
Right. Well, that's if you read his deposition testimony, that's just not. It doesn't reflect his testimony at all. Metzger testified. First of all, we don't need Metzger to testify as to damages. He could testify to his own time spent. Judge Duryagin never found that he could not testify about the time that he spent. And then there's no reason why we can't call all of the other 26 attorneys and so that they could testify to the time that they spent.
There were 26 attorneys that worked on this, we'll call it sanctions motion.
Right. But Metzger, in any event, was, we believe, fully capable of just giving a reasonable estimate. His estimate was 80 to 90% was basically the time that was devoted to this sanctions motion.
I don't see how that could possibly be true. It looked like everything was aimed at really this database that didn't turn out to actually exist.
Well, that's, I mean, whether everything is or not, that's for a jury to determine whether the 80 to 90% was credible.
What was the big fight? If you had to say one thing, was it this gender equity or the database?
Well, Metzger says that it was the gender equity studies. That's a running theme throughout his deposition. I mean, I've cited it in our brief. He says this was the smoking gun. This is what caused him the biggest concern in front of Judge Mim, and this is why he spent, you know, $700,000 of Latham's time, or $1 million of, you know, or a large part of that time, defending against the sanctions motion. But I mean, there were two things involved, certainly. And under Illinois law, you don't.
Yeah, but Judge Mim looked at this whole thing and thought it was worth a $10,000 sanction for not producing the gender equity study.
Right.
That's not a huge sanction in a case like this that's
lawyered
to this extent, is it?
Well, I would attribute to that, I mean, Metzger obviously did a good job in defending against
it. He
had
enough time on the case.
Yes, he did. You know, the reasonableness of that time is not an issue, as I think we've pointed out in our brief, just because, I mean, that was a bill that was paid in the ordinary course of business.
Well, one of the issues is how do you decide what dollars or what time was expended on the gender equity study as opposed to other issues.
And we believe that Metzger can give an estimate. But alternatively, if that's not acceptable, we could call these witnesses and parade these witnesses, and they could say, well, yeah, you know, this much of my time, they could try to say this much of my time was spent on the gender equity studies. I mean, there's a way to do it.
Yeah, I'm wondering how you do that.
Well, you would ask each witness how much. I mean, there were a few other tasks. That's the issue on damages, is that there are a few other tasks that aren't recoverable. So the witnesses would just have to say, to the best of their ability, how much of the time was devoted to defending against a sanctions motion as opposed to, like, a petition for certiorari, which wasn't recoverable, and some other tasks that weren't recoverable.
You tell me, just to kind of clear this up, who the defendant law firm was hired by the university because the insurance company took the case on a reservation of rights or something.
Right. The university hired Latham and Watkins. And
first the defendant law firm was
Giffen Winning
was hired
the defendant,
to
right.
represent the university and not TIG or whatever it is.
TIG.
TIG did not hire that law firm.
Yes, TIG paid for that.
Paid for it?
Yes.
But it was on a reservation of rights?
It was a reservation of rights.
So they had to get their own lawyer.
Right, and they got Latham & Watkins. Ultimately.
I guess I'm not making my... I'm sorry if my question is not clear, because I don't understand this. This law firm, the defendant law firm, is right. representing the university, at
right.
least in the EEOC proceedings,
right.
which were a couple of years before the lawsuit started. And that's when they say they got this gender equity report.
Right. They were representing it at that time.
Did the insurance company, I know they paid the bill, but did they have anything to do with hiring that law firm? Or did the law firm get hired by the university because the insurance company, TIG, took it on a reservation?
Latham? You mean the subsequent firm?
No.
The initial firm?
Yeah.
No, the initial firm was always the university's lawyers. That Giffen Winning was always their lawyers.
So they're counsel for the university,
right?
And they also had a $350,000 deductible or something.
Yes, there was a $350,000 self-insured retention.
And TIG came in after that,
right?
So how is it that TIG actually was responsible for paying Giffen at the outset?
It wasn't responsible at the outset.
So they didn't pay the first $350,000.
That's right.
I see.
But that was long before. I believe that was long before any of this.
Yeah. You know, but by that time,
this money was all our money. TIG's money.
Bosgate stayed with the case, I guess.
She stayed with the case until Latham came along.
And then you brought Latham into the case.
I believe the university hired Latham, but then we paid for Latham. And then we didn't pay for Giffen Winning anymore. We didn't need to pay for two law firms.
Well, I just say it's been a long time since I practiced law, but I'm just amazed at the number of attorneys and the amount of attorneys' fees wrapped into this whole thing. It's just mind-boggling to me.
It's a significant amount.
Yeah.
I agree, but...
And I'm wondering how
we paid that amount in good faith, and we paid it in the ordinary course of business. And under this circuit's law, I mean, that's prima facie reasonable. I mean, we were concerned about, we had issued a reservation of rights, and we didn't want to start penny pinching. We paid the bills as they came in. After Giffen and Winning, the defendants approved the Latham bills. They said that they approved them, and then we paid them. It's high, but it's...
The 26 attorneys worked on that.
That's my understanding, yes.
And you envision a trial where the district judge or a jury would listen to 26 lawyers testify and say, on May 10th, 1998, this bill says 7 hours work on this case. And
Judge Evans, I would hate to be a juror in that trial, but yeah. But that's... I mean, if need be... I mean, it's our position that Mester could give some reasonable percentage that the jury could accept or reject. You know, he was certainly positioned to be able to give a percentage. And otherwise, we could use summaries of the bills or, you know, there's a couple of different mechanisms, but, you know, if it came down to it, we would have to bring these people in, I guess. It's a little unwieldy, but that's what we would do.
TGI itself didn't lose anything, then, did it? TIG?
Well, TIG, we're reinsured. We are reinsured on this. Are you getting to the collateral source rule? The judge had held that we weren't, because we had reinsurance, then we couldn't recover because he said that the collateral source rule doesn't apply in legal malpractice cases. The rule says... To the tort defendant, obviously, you know, you don't get relieved of full responsibility for your loss just because the plaintiff made some independent contractual arrangement to protect itself. And as we pointed out in our briefs, there are two policies at work, typically. That one is to prevent the tortfeasor from escaping responsibility for his wrongdoing, and then to the extent you can also avoid a double recovery for the plaintiff, then that's fine. Sometimes the policies compete. Here there is no double recovery, so both of the policies are satisfied because TIG is obligated to forward any recovery here onto the reinsurers.
Were you obligated to bring the action?
To bring this action? I don't know. I don't think so, but I'm not sure. I guess we were out $700,000 or $1 million, so we felt obligated. So here there is no double recovery, but even if there were a double recovery, Illinois courts have held that that's preferable and more just than letting a wrongdoer off the hook. So the real question is, who's insured would you rather have to pay for a law firm's malpractice? And under the trial court's reasoning, he would put that loss on the plaintiff's insurer, and we believe that the loss better is allocated to the defendants, to the negligent defendant's insurer. I'm into my rebuttal time, so.
It's up to you. Sure.
Okay. Thank you.
Mr. Osborne.
May it please the court. This is a case that should never have even gotten to the summary judgment stage, much less survived summary judgment, because the plaintiff fails to state a claim that is recognized under Illinois law as it has been interpreted by this court. Of course, I'm speaking of Garris versus Schwartz, this court's decision from 1977, which holds that you cannot recover attorney's fees on a common law action unless there's a statute or a contract that provides for that. There's what's known as the third-party exception, where the defendant purportedly provoked litigation with a third party, between a third party and the plaintiff. But that third party exception, as this court points out in Garris, is limited to cases of intentional interference with a right to real estate, which of course this case is not. Third party exception has received varying interpretations from the Illinois appellate court. They rely on some Illinois appellate court decisions which hold that the third-party exception is basically unlimited, decisions which essentially ignore the intentional real estate qualification of the exception. But Garris versus Schwartz has never been overruled. Implicitly, they're asking this court to overrule its prior authority. They don't come right out and say it in their brief, but there's no question, and they don't dispute, that if this court were to follow its prior authority in Garris, then a dismissal would have been proper in this case. This court has held before that once it makes a pronouncement on an issue of state law, it won't disturb that unless and until the Illinois appellate court in the interim changes the law, or if there's some other extraordinary circumstance. The fact that the Illinois appellate court has waffled on this issue, and there's really no other way to put it. I mean, there are cases on both sides of this issue. Doesn't mean that this court should do the same. It would only, as we put in our brief, introduce further confusion for the issue to be confused in the federal system as well as the state system.
Can you tell me why that gender equity study was not turned over?
Well, the gender equity studies, there were three of them at issue in the motion for sanctions.
And we're only talking about two here.
Two, it's not entirely clear whether it's one or two, but it's a fine point. They were sent to my client by general counsel for ISU, Renee Smith Bias, under a cover letter that basically just said, FYI. This is when the EEOC charge was filed. Not produce it in discovery, not hang on to it in case we need to produce it in discovery, nothing about a lawsuit. My client spent, I think, an hour looking at it, and if you look at this study, you can see it would have to be a fast read to understand this in an hour. Certainly not, in depth. She puts it in the file. This is in 1994. 1996, when the lawsuit is filed, we come up on the second request to produce documents. The response was filed in October of 1996, 2 years later. Now, of course, what my clients did is when they got, there were many, many discovery requests. I mean, we're just looking at this under a microscope. They sent the discovery request to ISU, explained it to them. They said, you know, produce all the documents or give us all the documents that are responsive. We'll go through it and see what's privileged, create a privilege log, and then produce the balance to the plaintiff. Well, these gender equity studies were not among the documents that were sent over by ISU to my client. And the reason for that is the person with knowledge that this request was routed to by general counsel was Dr. Gorell, who created one of the studies, was involved in one of the other studies.
All right, well, I can maybe short-circuit this. When the issue of non-production of that gender equity report came up, okay, I understand this Bellows guy was talking to Gorell, and Gorell told him about the study and all that.
Shortly after the response to the second request, Gorell went to Bellows and said, look what they didn't give you.
Right. Now, why at that point wasn't it turned over right away?
Well, my understanding, if I've got the timeline correct, is that there was a stay entered sua sponte by the magistrate on an 11th immunity issue came to this court, up to the United States Supreme Court, back down to this court. There was a two-year stay. It was during the period of the stay that, and of course, you know, once my client recalled that, I had, you know, seen these gender equity studies, and recall there wasn't a subpoena served on the law firm here. This is a Rule 34 request on ISU. They're saying because she saw these studies 2 years earlier, she should have known that it wasn't among these hundreds of thousands of pages of documents that ISU had sent over to be produced. In any event, it was less than a week, I believe, before the stay entered. Immediately, she scheduled meetings with Dr. Gorell and Dr. Chismar to find out about these studies, to find out if there was a privilege that should be asserted or whether they should just be turned over.
Postgate?
Yes, Carol Postgate. Before that issue could be worked out, the stay came down. My client testified that her understanding of a stay is that you do not proceed with discovery, and I think that's fairly well settled. In any event, Latham and Watkins came in at about that time to brief the immunity issue before this court and the United States Supreme Court and stayed on. They took the lead, if you will. My client did remain in the case. I think my opponent misspoke when they said she withdrew. She did stay in the case. Latham essentially took charge of the case. They were calling the shots. And so when the stay came off, Mr. Bellows immediately wrote a letter saying, we have these gender equity studies. We want the database. We need to get together and talk about this. Why hasn't it been produced? Latham and Watkins basically wrote letters back saying, well, you're deficient in your own discovery responses. They didn't broach the issue, really. They stonewalled, I mean, to put it politely. And so Bellows filed his motion for sanctions. That's the whole, you know, meet and confer period was handled entirely by Latham. That wasn't my client's responsibility. So I don't know. Does that answer your question as to why this didn't come out when it did? But by that time, Bellows had the studies. I mean, clearly, and I think that...
Well, he had them as soon as he talked to
Gorell. Right. Jumping ahead to the but-for issue, they want to say, and I was a little confused by their argument because I thought they're saying for the first time now that damages consist of the difference between what the motion for sanctions was and what the motion for sanctions would have been if the gender equity studies had been produced earlier. So in other words, it's not the whole thing. I mean, they've been arguing in their briefs and in the district court that the damages are the entirety of the motion for sanctions. They've never given any indication how you subdivide that into different parts. They've taken the position that it's the entire motion for sanctions, and that's what we're trying to measure here. Well, that puts them in an impossible position on proximate cause because then they have to show that the motion for sanctions wouldn't have been filed, not just that it would have been less contentious because they can't give us any idea of how much time was spent on just the gender equity study issue. I asked their expert that specifically. He had no idea. I asked Mr. Mester that specifically, just as to your time, how much did you spend on the gender equity studies issue as opposed to the database and all these other issues? No idea. No clue. And as for all these other timekeepers, I mean, their affidavits were not submitted in opposition to our motion for summary judgment. So I don't think that comes in. I don't think that ought to be considered.
Well, does it come down to no damages or just a total inability to prove any? Because maybe they way overreacted to this I guess you'd say discovery of the gender equity study, that they overreacted and spent an inordinate amount of time, but isn't it worth $100,000 as opposed to $1.2 million?
No, our position is that there are no damages, because even if you try to figure out what did just the gender equity studies issue involve, recall that ISU was independently accused of hiding the gender equity studies. They authored the gender equity studies. Renee Smith Bias, general counsel for ISU, wrote that supposedly incriminating letter to my client forwarding the gender equity studies issue, the gender equity studies. So she had at least as much knowledge as my client did. She's not a typical general counsel either. She entered an appearance in Varner. She took depositions in Varner. She helped pull together the discovery responses in Varner. So ISU had its own problem that it needed to defend on the gender equity studies issue, not just my client. And there's no, you know, even if you were to allow that there might be some incidental damages from my client's failing to recognize that the gender equity studies had not been produced by its client, well, our clients hired their own lawyer. They paid her bills in the motion for sanctions, and those are not at issue here. If Mark Mester and Latham and Watkins were gratuitously defending my client's supposed missteps, they had no duty to do so. And what's more, Mr. Mester testified that he wasn't doing that. He viewed this situation as a conflict between my client and ISU. His defense to the motion for sanctions was to paint Renee Smith Bias as sort of this babe in the woods who didn't know anything and was just relying on her lawyers, pointing the finger at my clients. So I don't see how any of their fees could be recoverable. They had their, you know, maybe they were unfairly accused by Bellows of hiding this database that didn't exist. But that's a Rule 11 or a Rule 37 issue. That's not common law damages against my client. But the point that I was trying to make earlier is that clearly this motion for sanctions would have been filed even if the gender equity studies had been produced earlier, because Exhibit M, Document 170, our bound volume, that's the hearing before Judge Mim, closing arguments before Judge Mim, pages 4 and 5 of Exhibit M. Mr. Bellows is asked to sum up his argument. He goes through this laundry list of all of these supposed discovery violations, and he said the reason that the gender equity studies were not produced, the reason that all of these other things were done, was to conceal the database from him. Well, the database didn't exist. And if we take Mr. Bellows at his word that he was serious about getting this database, and no reasonable plaintiff's lawyer in a gender discrimination case would let something like that go, he has an affidavit from the fellow who supposedly created the database. If he's intent on getting the database and the database doesn't exist, well, then the motion for sanctions is inevitable.
Well, would it have been something on the order of, well, they didn't produce this gender equity study, and we've got it, and we know they had it, so that's just the tip of the iceberg of what is all submerged, and we know there's a lot more there, therefore this little nugget is evidence of the whole, whatever you want to call it, non-disclosure. But right. Is that still the touch point where, but for that, it wouldn't have got going?
If we take Mr. Bellows at his word that he thinks the reason these gender equity studies were hidden from him was because the way they're formatted, the way it's laid out in a table, the information that's in there, it's clear that it was created using a comprehensive personnel database, which coincides with Mr. Gorell's testimony. If we take him at his word, then what difference would it have made if he had gotten the gender equity studies earlier? That would have just caused him to come to the same conclusion earlier. It wouldn't have caused him to come to a different... I mean, surely, if my clients had come forward in October of 1996 and said, here are the gender equity studies, Bellows says, well, Burrell tells me there's a database, or his deposition was set, so that eventually would have come out. Burrell says there's a database. I ask you, my clients say, there's no database. We're not giving you the database that you're asking for. It doesn't exist. Well, of course he's going to file a motion for sanctions. Of course they're going to have to go through ISU's computer system and 2 billion bytes of information, which is, appears to be most of the time that these Latham lawyers spent looking for this purported database. All you need are Gorell's affidavit and Bellows' affidavit to show that he was intent on getting this database. And after, I mean, any employment discrimination case, that's an invaluable tool to have the defendant's own personnel database that matches up payroll information with qualitative factors.
Well, whose side was Gorell on, anyway?
Well, it's an interesting question. He worked for ISU up until the time that he filed his own lawsuit. He was obviously working hand in glove with Bellows. He obviously had a deep animus for ISU.
Well, did he misrepresent the fact that there was a database, or he just not know and assume there was?
Well,
or is that still a question?
I have my own thoughts on that. But from the record, he signed an affidavit that said described in detail this database. And then when he was asked on the stand, "Tell us more about this database," he said, "I never touched a keyboard. You know, everything I did was through my assistants." So they put his assistant on the stand. "Tell us about the database." "There is no database. I spent weeks running around the university pulling stuff out of boxes trying to do this study. I wish there had been a database." And that's what Judge Mim found. There was no database. So all of this was inevitable. There's no way that they could have foregone these fees. They're just looking at my client as a convenient scapegoat to pin all this on, essentially. If there are no further questions, thank you.
Thanks. Mr. Balson?
4.5
You have 4.5 minutes.
Your Honors, this question, whether this database would have been filed or not, is a question for a jury. We might not win on the issue of causation, but we've got testimony of Mester that believes that the failure to produce the database was indicative of bad faith, and that is what caused Bellows to file this motion and burrow deeply.
You say the database. I thought the database doesn't exist.
I mean the studies.
The studies. Not
right.
The database doesn't exist.
Right. That's Judge Mim found the database doesn't exist. But the failure, I meant to say the studies. If I said otherwise, I apologize. A jury might determine that the failure to produce these studies had no effect. But we have Mester's testimony that said, yes, it did have an effect. And that's, I mean, we're here on summary judgment. We just want to go to the jury on this. In order to get a trial, you don't have to prove that you're going to win the trial. We believe that there's evidence from which a jury could conclude not only that that was a motivating factor in filing the motion for sanctions, and even if there were other motivating factors, then under Illinois law, I mean, all it needs to be is a cause. It could combine with other causes, and then the tortfeasor is responsible for the natural consequences. So that, under Illinois law, would put the Giffen and Winning responsible for all of the consequences, which in our view, a jury might accept it or reject it, is the time that the Latham attorney spent to fight against the sanctions motion. All we're asking is to go before a jury on this question. My opponent talks a very good game about why he should win. Well, that's a fine argument, but it's not for this court. It's for the trier of fact. Now, on the issue of damages, Judge Mannion, you asked whether there were none or whether it's just that they're difficult to prove. I mean, we've got a number of ways that we can prove them. I mean, definitely some of this was, I mean, we paid for a lot of money for Latham & Watkins to combat the non-production of the studies and to combat the sanctions motion. I mean, we on summary judgment, it's not our burden to allegate to allocate precisely and say, yes, our damages are $463,240. We have a right to be able to prove that there, I mean, in that Nicolette case, Judge Posner said that our burden is that we have to prove on summary judgment that their negligence caused us some harm, and the jury, and that it could be quantified to a reasonable, which is not to say a high degree of precision.
See, the problem I think here, and maybe I'm looking at this the wrong way, and you can tell me if I am, but it seems that bringing this other law firm in created all the problems. A defendant is defending a lawsuit. There's a claim that the defense didn't comply with a discovery request appropriately. So you litigate that out in a sanctions matter, and here there's 4 days of hearings before Judge Mim. And now if it turned out that the law firm should have turned something over as opposed to the university itself, that would normally be taken care of in the bill for services rendered by the law firm defending the university, wouldn't it? In other words, you bring a new law firm in here, and the meter starts running, and they go through all this stuff, and now you want to stick
right, but the defendant. But the client hired that law firm.
Yeah, but the client did because you took the you wouldn't defend without a reservation of rights, right?
Right, but I mean, it's our right to defend with a reservation of rights. I mean that's. It's what insurers
yeah,
do.
But you also made the decision to bring the Latham into the case.
I believe that was ISU that made that decision to bring him in. Oh, we paid for them.
Yeah.
I mean, we paid the bill. And we think that failure to turn those studies over had some causative effect in the filing of this motion and the incurrence of these fees. And on summary judgment, I mean, there might be other causes. A jury might not agree with us, we might lose, but we don't have to prove to get a trial that we're going to win the trial. And that's what our position basically comes down to on this appeal.
Okay.
My time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, thanks. This case will be taken under advisement.